Right, I think we're live now. So I'm here with Keith Woods, and I discovered your channel a few weeks ago. Can't remember now. I think somebody linked us to it on Twitter or something. Well, I just thought it was absolute brilliant content. What the hell's going on there? And I thought it was excellent, all the stuff that I had on your channel. I think we need a lot more of it in the movement. And how are you keeping?
Not too bad, Morgoth. It's good to be here, and it's great to see you discover my channel, because not just saying it, but to blow smoke, which you're one of my favorite channels on YouTube at the minute. And I agree, especially this side of the pond. I think we need a more intelligent nationalism. You know, a lot of the populist parties here, they've kind of got trapped in that kind of Thatcherite neoliberal paradigm, you know, where they might oppose open borders, but they'll also have these policies that are really antithetical to a nationalist worldview. So I think we need to start forging this third position over here, you know. In a lot of ways, the United States, they're kind of a generation ahead of us in some ways, in the replacement that's going on there in terms of demographics and everything else. So it's kind of a sign of things to come. And if we can learn from what's happening there and from some of the intellectual progress that's been made in circles of the right over there and transfer it over here, I think that's very important. And I think your channel especially is a fine example of that.
Thanks a lot. I mean, one of the things we've got in common is that we're both pretty critical of capitalism, which is this is something which, like you were saying, is happening a lot more in the American scene. And it's something that global, the sort of woke capital, I've spoke about it a lot recently, and is coming in, and it's impossible to ignore. And it's actually quite a relief that you can finally see the true nature of the beast. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I actually started out as a leftist, but I never really felt like I was at home with these beliefs, because what I was looking for was something beyond like the rootless nihilistic individualism. And of course the media portrays, you know, the white Christian Republican as the perfect example of that. You know, he just wants to cut taxes and take money off poor people. And, you know, so you get drawn when you're looking for something beyond yourself out of this nihilistic paradigm. You can get drawn to leftist collectivism, but then you realize that if you look into it deeply enough, that these leftist beliefs are motivated by the same kind of nihilistic individualism as the so-called right, the conservatives. They just have a disagreement on how best to achieve these ends. And so yeah, then when you discover this, whatever you want to call it, the third position, or you know, I just call it nationalism. When you discover that there is an alternative to these nihilistic worldviews, it is quite a relief. It's like coming home in a way. You're like, you know, my beliefs actually do make sense. They're a coherent body of belief and ideology. Because you've always been told that certain positions you can't hold together. You know, if you're pro universal healthcare, you have to be pro open borders for some reason, and you have to accept all the global homo stuff with the economic policies.
Yeah, or if you go on the right, you have to sort of praise global corp and big business. And if you're lucky, you might get a few conservative values sprinkled in there, though we don't even get that now. I mean, one of the things that we kind of spoke, I'm going to have to say as well, that I might be a little bit low energy tonight because I've got some sort of infection in one of my eyes. So I might not be in the usual self, but one of the things we're going to get into was the sort of postmodernism which you spoke about on your channel, which I'm really interested in, and cultural Marxism. But we kind of decided before we went on air that it was kind of the same muck coming from a different group. But I remember, did you watch the Zizek and Jordan Peterson debate? Because that was an interesting one, because in that one, Peterson went in and he expected to do the sort of normicon thing of talking about gulags and all of the 100 million dead. And Zizek kind of pulled a fast one on him and threw all of the postmodernism, or at least he was like saying, where are all these cultural Marxists that you're talking about? And Peterson kind of couldn't explain it. And I noticed like more people seem to be saying that cultural Marxism isn't really a thing. It's all postmodernism. And I thought that might be an interesting thing to get into, but it does just seem like splitting hairs, doesn't it?
Well, you see, I find what happens with a lot of people that get very obsessive over the cultural Marxism thing is in a lot of ways they haven't understood this third position that we're talking about. And they basically think that they're still in this false binary of capitalism and communism, and that there's good guys and bad guys. And if we can just defeat the enemy, it's kind of this conspiratorial thinking that you get with boomers a lot and with the QAnon stuff, that if we can just defeat this group of evil, whatever they are, pedophiles or Satanists or whatever, that then everything will be okay. And it's kind of a reluctance to deal with maybe deeper structural issues that brought us here. And I wouldn't for a second deny kind of the invidious effects of critical theory and postmodernism and all this. But I think you have to look at how does something like this infect your society in the first place? And one of the problems is that the ontology of liberalism that's completely accepted in the West and isn't really questioned, it leaves yourself open for this kind of thing. And that's why Peterson can only take you so far. And he can't go any further. And that's why he couldn't really engage intelligently with Zizek, because Peterson actually can't see outside this Enlightenment paradigm.
Yeah. So, I mean, so Zizek's point was that the dislocation and the lack of identity in modernity is a creation of your value system. This is liberalism and capitalism reaching its logical conclusion, and it's people aren't happy with it. And it's kind of like, you can say whatever you want about what happened in the Soviet Union or what Joseph Stalin did or whatever it happens to be, but you're gonna have to answer for what's happening in the world here and now, not me. It was a clever play, to be honest.
Yeah, and the other thing is, just as a factual point, like Stalin completely changed the whole outlook of the USSR, where they went from this party that was run by, you know, a certain group of Bolshevik internationalists. And by the 50s, they were putting out this literature attacking modern art and attacking the internationalism of capitalism. And, you know, Stalin and the USSR were supporting nationalist movements. And Kerry Bolton writes about this, how it was the USSR that basically stopped New World Order, the New World Order coming to fruition after World War II, because they had in mind that through these agreements that were drafted by technocrats in the US, specifically a nuclear agreement, that nuclear weapons would be controlled centrally by the UN, that they were going to institute this, you know, end to history, this finally they'd have this this utopia that people like Kant dreamed of, this liberal utopia. And Stalin basically put an end to this, and he started supporting what we'd now call the kind of Nazball movements around the world. And so it's been Russia since the time of Stalin that's been resisting this unipolar movement to Anglo-American liberalism. And what happened with the, you know, the people that are responsible for the Bolshevik Revolution, what happened them under Stalin is they fled to the US. You know, Trotsky fled to Mexico, and he started working with these internationalist lobby groups in the United States. And then these Trotskyists, they morphed into what's now neoconservatism, and they set up groups like the CFR, which is the biggest think tank on American foreign policy in the US. It was started by the Rockefellers, but it quickly got taken over by these Trotskyites. And they also became very prominent in the modern art movement, to the point where it's on record that the CIA was funding the work of Jackson Pollock, and they were promoting modern art in these peripheral countries around the Soviet Union. So this was how the Trotskyite internationalist vision, this was how it morphed once it lost its grip on the Soviet Union. It basically embraced Anglo-American liberalism and the United States empire as its method of being spread throughout the world. So when people have this static view of, you know, communism versus capitalism and, you know, the Reds versus the freedom loving Americans, they fail to see the deeper significance of what's going on, which is that these people, ideology is no crux for them. They're willing to change their outward beliefs, but the, you know, what's more, the underlying motivation doesn't change. And the real paradigm is internationalism versus nationalism. It's globalist homogeneity versus nationalist identity. And if you fall into capitalism versus communism, you fail to see what's really going on.
What do you say a sort of postmodern art is like the aesthetic of internationalism then?
Yeah, exactly. It's you know, again, it's this drive to homogeneity, and it's all about the quantitative over the qualitative worldview, and it just turns into this deconstructionism. But in a way, it's kind of it's taken the philosophy of liberalism to its height, because at the end of modern art is that you look at a piece by someone like Jackson Pollock, and there's no referential point. There's nowhere you can focus your eyes on the canvas. There's nothing you can relate it to. It's outside time. It's outside space. It's outside any cultural reference points. And this is basically what happens with the philosophy of liberalism. It starts out sounding very nice with individual rights and all this, but it inevitably falls into this anarchistic, narcissistic focus on the self, and it leads to complete relativism outside of an underlying mythos.
But and postmodernism is kind of like, I mean, beyond like cultural Marxism, critical theory, postmodernism does seem to be where it is liberalism deconstructing itself, where everything becomes subjective and there is no underlying premise of the society. And it seems to be a sort of just sort of intellectualized madness, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. I did a small bit of prep for this. So I went reading critical race theorists and Judith Butler, and my good God, I mean, it's just absolute torture. But that's what it is. I mean, these people, the people especially, you know, people are aware of these terms like white privilege and intersectionality. And these are basically liberal concepts. You know, the concept of intersectionalism was invented by Kimberly Crenshaw, who's a black critical race theorist. And these critical legal theorists that have advanced this critical race theory, which is all the anti-white stuff you're familiar with, they're mostly liberals. And it is, that can sound counterintuitive, because it's all this talk and collectivism about people being created by their identities of oppression, like if they're a black woman, that their blackness and their being a woman in a patriarchal white society, that's what defines them. But again, what you have to understand is that it's only collectivism insofar as it advances this very nihilistic, relativistic, anarchistic ontology that's underlying it. And the end point is this narrow concept they have of negative freedom, which is basically freedom from any concept of responsibility or constraint or loyalty or duty to any greater mythos. And yeah, it is the end point of individualism and liberalism, just this quagmire of utter nonsense. It's narcissism.
Yeah. I mean, if the typical thing where if you're a man and then you demand everybody calls you a woman, within liberalism, that's actually a serious point, because you're treading on his or her individuality if you choose not to do that. So this is a kind of a discussion which a genuine liberal would probably have to take seriously. Whereas if you're more of a traditionalist, you can just tell them to get lost and call them ridiculous. But in sort of the modern liberal, I think that's a hard thing for them to deal with, because, well, if he's an individual and he says you have to call him a woman, then, yeah, maybe you do.
Yeah, and, you know, it's also this kind of ontology that I guess started with Descartes, where everything starts from the self and everything starts from the reference point of your own ego. You know, it starts with the cogito, I think, therefore I am. And ultimately, all truth has to subsume itself to your will. And, you know, the very concept of objective truth becomes something very questionable when you begin your whole worldview from this egoistic point of view.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember reading Hegel's critique of Descartes, I think, therefore I am, and that was a real eye-opener to me. That was about a year ago or something when I stumbled across it for an article or something I was writing. And it was that, you know, he says he's an individual. I can't remember it exactly, but it was like, I think, therefore I am, and yet he's thinking in French and writing it in Latin at a specific time and place in the world, and he's been influenced by the wider Christian society. There's absolutely nothing individualistic about any of that.
Absolutely, yeah. It's like you know, it's like Heidegger mentions a lot, this concept of thrownness, that you're thrown into the world with this particular set of traditions and this cultural body that's as much a part of your being as this abstraction of the self.
I mean, an interesting thing, just to get back on the intersectionality stuff and how it sort of ties in with postmodernism, is that when you postmodernism is that there's no kind of absolute or grounding to anything. And yeah, the funny thing is, it seems that that's not actually the case, because certain events in that happened in World War II, supposedly, you know, let's not get into that, but World War II in general, the National Socialist Party, some of these really controversial issues, they are unquestionable. In a postmodern society, that's one place where you can't go. And yet, in theory, of course, it's like everything's up for grabs. And I just see it as another means of insidious destruction rather than a genuine sort of philosophical movement. And do you know what I mean? Because there is some area, places where it won't go, that it won't deconstruct.
Yeah, well, you see, this is the thing with every ideological system, any body of belief, which is that, you know, it's like Kurt Gödel's incompleteness theorem that applies to maths. You know, something can be complete or provable, but it can't be both. And so for every system of belief, you have to start with an unquestioned presupposition. And these people claim to be doing their work outside this paradigm. And they'll deconstruct things like, you know, they'll say these are Enlightenment concepts of justice that were formed by a white patriarchy. And so we can throw this out. And they'll deconstruct everything that they feel is oppressive as being historically and culturally contingent. But then what's their argument for their own policies? They appeal to concepts like justice and freedom. But, you know, once they've thrown out everything as being contingent on a certain cultural historical epoch, it's like, well, what do you have to appeal for your demand for justice or freedom? You know, why should I not impose my will on you if, like Foucault says, everything, you know, knowledge can't be extricated from power, and everything is basically this nihilistic battle for control, and concepts like objective truth are just used in service of that.
And so on the one hand, you get sort of postmodernism as this destructive force, but it's actually a bit of a con, because at the same time, the intersectionality is actually doing the opposite with protected groups and giving them a sort of, and in what's, I mean, the thing that I'm going to start and talk about a lot more is the concept of whiteness, because when you carry that through, it's absolutely horrific. Because what they're doing, it's almost like a metaphysical construct that they've created, and then what people who are now minority groups can then understand European civilization through that prism, and it means that absolutely everything would have to be torn down, or they can justify tearing anything down and where does that leave actual European people? Because if they, everything is oppressive to them, or rather that their lived existence is always going to be outsiders, while the this construct of whiteness, which you can't measure it, you can't quantify it, it's this sort of mysterious force which is they've created, then the deconstruction will never end. There was somebody called Kehinde Andrews, I think I've mentioned this before, but he went to South Africa and was complaining at the state of South Africa post-apartheid, and he said it was the problem that was like the legacy of toxic whiteness, and his book was called The Psychosis of Whiteness. So you can see that even when the South Africans are trying desperately to get away and section themselves off and leave the whole country to the blacks, they're still going to be blamed because of this concept of whiteness. That's absolutely horrific.
Yeah, another good example of that is, you know, there was this bitch a few years ago that had this book, White Angst, and basically her thing was that what white people are doing wrong now is that when white people talk to a person of color and they try to treat them as someone purely based on their personality, and they say, you know, I don't take race into account, and they try and treat that person perfectly, equitably and equally, that's now a form of oppression, because it's actually your arrogance as a white person to say that you can communicate with this person outside of race, when, you know, they're coming from this history of oppression that has shaped their entire life. And how arrogant of you to try and put this all behind and act like race isn't a factor.
Yeah, because whiteness is the normative value. That's like the default setting of society. And so that we can't understand their lived experience. So again, it is liberal as well, because, you know, it's all about the individual. We can't understand how this individual interacts with the world in that way. And it is this metaphysical thing that they're creating, while we are being deconstructed, they are being emboldened with something like that. And it's only, you can just see the seeds being planted, but you can just sort of see where this is all going to go. And this thing of whiteness, I think it's an absolute, that people have to watch for this. That people have to watch for this concept of whiteness.
Yeah.
And go on.
Just that example of, you know, when someone says, well, you can't actually debate me on this because you don't know what it is to have my experience of growing up as a black woman in a white patriarchy, or whatever the example is. You know, if your belief system leads to basically denying any concept of objective reality or truth, or even the potential for there to be a communication or an attempt at truth between two subjects, that should be a reductio ad absurdum to your underlying philosophical belief. You've gone wrong somewhere if you end up denying objective reality based on what started out as a political belief.
Yeah. I remember when I first heard the term white privilege, it was because Laurie Penny did an article and there was some a blog about it in the Daily Telegraph. And it's a strange thing, because you can see them sort of polishing and like sort of tweaking this new weapon that they've got, which is going to get ruled out. And it's the white privilege theories everywhere now. There's no arguing against it. If you try and argue against it, it's just a sign that you are suffering from white privilege.
Yeah. I mean, I remember a particularly egregious example. I wasn't even too red-pilled at the time, but there was this talk that we should replace philosophers on the academic philosophy courses in college because it was full of white men. And so I was arguing with this guy I know who's in law that this was obviously ridiculous. And his whole thing was that, you know, you only think these people are good based on you being a white male, and that basically there's no objective standard of quality of their intellectual work. And what you find with people that have this completely relativistic worldview, it's very common now. But I think that this kind of grows out of the materialism that comes before it. And, you know, in a world that's so dominated by technique and science, and where everyone puts their trust in the constant progress of the technocrats, the engineers, the scientists, it's logical that you'll get this this superstructure of belief that's based on this matter in the void view of reality that's totally empty of any concepts of transcendence or anything beyond the individual will. So it really is, it's a deeper problem, and it really gets to the heart of where the West is going and where we've gone wrong. And you start to realize, the more you look into these things, it's so much deeper than a group of leftists that have hijacked things. It's really it's like a spiritual decay that's in European man.
Yeah. I mean, do you sort of view it as a Spenglerian thing, where it's as if a plant, I mean, and this is like the ultimate black pill, but like it's sort of the plant, it's sort of the seed blooms, and then you have the culture phase, which is just really dynamic, and then it kind of goes into the civilization phase, where it's expansive, and then it sort of just withers and decays and drops in on itself. Because I mean, even something like postmodernism, regardless of who was behind it, was kind of predicted by Spengler, because the civilization doesn't have any metaphysics anymore, so it cannot express itself anymore. So what you get is just this, where it's literally like symbols, and it's as if the people behind sort of postmodern art, let's say, or postmodernism in general, have actually cottoned onto that, and they're sort of doing it consciously when it should be unconscious. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I absolutely think there's something to this cyclical view of history and civilization. But I actually think that it's become kind of more invidious in our own case. I used the example of Jacques Ellul, who was an inspiration for Ted Kaczynski. And he was really the first philosopher to study in a comprehensive way the phenomenon of technology and the effect it was having on society. And he came up with this concept of technique, which is, it's not any particular technology or collection of technologies, or even our attitudes to technology or how they're shaped by technology. But it's like the collection of all those things. It's this ideological state, technological apparatus. And what happens at a certain point in history is this apparatus of technique becomes autonomous of human will, and it starts to shape human will. And I think that's what's happening now. Ideology always follows the needs of technique. So, you know, technique for efficiency to expand itself. And this is another characteristic that Ellul identifies, is that it's always expanding, but it's not expanding to any particular end. It's just what it does. It expands. So, you know, technique, in order to expand, it needs a larger workforce. It needs more efficiency. It needs freedom of movement. And so it needs an end to something like borders. And then following on from that, you get all these ideological political movements advocating open borders. But ultimately, Ellul has this very black pill view that we're basically, we've lost control of technique, and we're kind of slaves to technique without even realizing it, and we follow the will of technique and its constant expansion.
And there's some people like True Diltom, I think it is, and they are saying the way out of this is just to sort of break it apart and have these small kind of eco-friendly communities. I think I could be wrong there, but some of them, you know, some more thoughtful people on the right are definitely coming up, thinking of ways to just break all of this system down. Because if that, I mean, you know, the eco thing is like a sort of globalist straw man, but at the same time, we just can't live on a planet with this level of consumption forever, and something will have to be done about it. It's a strange thing, because they're offering a false solution. Globalism offers a false solution to the problem that it created in the first place, or let's say in modern world and technology, the technology question. And these are spaces which should be which people on the right should be filling, instead of constantly having some sort of controlled opposition group like that. I did a video on it. What was it called? They were like lying on the ground in London like a few months back. I can't remember them now. Extinction Rebellion and all of this rubbish. And you see all of the sort of globalist elite coming out and getting on board. But of course, all it ever means is that what they're doing is asking for more centralized control, because they're then demanding on the European Union and the UN to step in and to have more control over people's consumption.
Well, this is what controlled opposition is. You know, you did a great video on Stormzy as controlled opposition, and I think people sometimes they kind of have this false view of controlled opposition as like these elites or, you know, the CIA or something hiring people to lead a political movement. But it's more like what we talked about earlier. You know, the fact that these critical theorists, they attack these concepts like justice and freedom as being oppressive constructs of a male patriarchy, but they ultimately don't have anything to replace it with. They're ultimately attacking it from the precepts that were given to them by someone else, while claiming to be outside of that contingent cultural paradigm. And it's the same with something like the ecological catastrophe we're facing, which is created by this system of global neoliberal capitalism. And ultimately, they provide you the solutions like any other product.
They give you ideas, isn't it? Even like this, what we had, what that American footballer sort of clicked his fingers and had a flag, a more traditional American flag, dropped from Nike this week, and you just wonder, well, who is it that he's standing up against? And the way it was framed would be that it's this sort of generic fascism or hate. Which is just the past. Now the past is hate and has to be eradicated by global homo tech.
Yeah, and another example. I mean, you see this all the time now with neoliberalism, where the guilt of being within the system of this very advanced form of late stage capitalism. The guilt that's associated with that is now marketed as a product within that. So now when you book flights on your budget airline, you get an option to tick a box at the end to donate £1 or €1 to offset the carbon emissions of your flight. And, you know, you see this, you know, the fair trade options and, you know, options to do all these kind of meaningless things that people love it because, you know, being part of this system that we're constantly told is doing this great historically untold creating this great ecological catastrophe on the third world, then the perfect product to sell to people with money, to the upper middle class and the middle class, is the opportunity to offset this guilt. But of course, when it's stuck within the paradigm of the people that are doing it, providing you with that option, it's completely meaningless.
That's actually a great take. The idea that they can now market white guilt, that like they saw global homo. I wonder if they've got spreadsheets somewhere about the market value of white guilt. That's actually what the Copernican Nike trainers think. So, you know, you've got all the sort of normie cons coming out and saying, oh, well, I'm throwing away my Nike trainers. But it's very possible that the CEOs and the board in Nike have actually sort of factored in the white guilt market and thought, you old Republican patriotards, you can all piss off because we've got this new market of white guilt types and that'll make up for you. That's why it can survive. That's how woke capital will survive on white guilt. It's a good, I really like that actually.
Yeah, that's, I really hate this take of, you know, get woke, go broke. because again, it's this kind of idealistic thing that, like, the, you know, the market will ultimately fix it, and it's like a market solution to a market problem. You know, if these companies if they start pushing this anti-white stuff, you know, people will just shop elsewhere, and the market will save us. It's this total inability to take any action beyond this this kind of facile conservatism.
All right, I'm going to read out a few super chats when I get them up here. So it's we've been on half an hour, so let's go. Lee and Mark and I have this name. I think he's one of your lads. Braith High, £2. What does he reckon about a return to Brehon Law?
Brehon Law. No, I don't really. I mean, we could go back to trading cows to compensate for criminal offences, but I don't really see that happening. I think the solution needs to be more international. You know, I find Irish nationalists, I mean, I can understand it, tend to be very, very insular looking. But, I mean, what happened when we got independence was we kind of remained a colony of the UK. Nothing really changed. And then since the 90s, we've become a colony of the United States culturally. And we're now colonized by these multinationals, which institute whatever social changes they want. And ultimately, there's only so much you can do as a very small country off the coast of the Atlantic. And I think the solution may need to be more broadly European based.
All right. Super chat, Steve. Oh, thanks for a lot. Thanks a lot there, Ree and Mac and Bratham High. And super chat, Steve Bob, £2. Sickening with Tommy today, but totally expected. Well, I haven't followed it. You know, I've been arguing with people on Twitter today about the Tommy situation. So I guess, yeah, it does look like they're out to sort of get rid of him, to bump him off. Why and all the rest of it, I don't know. But I'm not going to lie. So yesterday, I mean, his new documentary coming out is called Shalom. I can't, you know, I'd prefer it if it was called, well, why is it called Shalom and not, let's say, the rape of Rochdale? There's only so much of this I can take. There really is.
Hasn't he learned yet that elite are never going to take his side, no matter how much he signals to things he thinks they believe in?
Yeah. I'd even if he just said nothing, you know, I could deal with that, but not when it's this obvious and it's insulting. But all right, that's enough. Let's have a look on the Stalin thing. Stalin was internationalist. He funded and trained every single socialist party of South America, tried to destroy church here. I don't know about that, because I've read the Kerry Bolton that you were talking about as well. And it was very much the Stalin sort of broke up the Comintern, and it was literally communism in one nation. That could be the case, that he did funnel some money into South America. I'd be surprised if he tried to destroy a church, because, like you were saying, it became quite socially conservative afterwards, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that South America stuff was kind of post-Stalin. I think that was more 1960s, 70s, but I mean, I could be wrong on that. But I'm not aware of much activity between Stalin and South American paramilitaries or anything like that, you know?
No, I don't think there was much going on in South America, because he died in 1953. But there was a lot of activity in South America a little bit later. MJ, £4.99. Thank you very much, by the way, for everybody for these. Have a pint on me, Morgoth. If anyone deserves it, you do. Well, I will have one tonight, because I've literally my eyes falling down my face. The lovely Lady Rotha, who always pops up, buy herself some eye drops, £15. Get well soon. I'll get some bloody good eye drops for that, Lady Rotha. Thank you very much. Sam Sheridan, £5. We need to deconstruct the deconstructors. We need to subvert the subverters. expose their weaknesses and why they do this. That's a good point. And that's kind of like what we're doing now, what me and Keith are up to now, and what we do on our YouTube channels. People, you know, I've made sort of videos on, like, which I do a lot as movies, and I can kind of hang a lot of ideas on there and get into the text, and I get comments, and it'll be like, meanwhile, our people are being replaced in our towns and villages, as if saying you always need to be going on about this. But we need to understand these ideas. We need to understand what it is that we're really dealing with before we can find a way out of it, beyond just saying no more immigrants. Like what Keith especially has been talking about tonight with all of these intellectual movements and global, the technical side of it, technology, it all does kind of converge in the modern world. Would you agree on that?
Yeah, I mean, you get that a lot. There's always the detractors saying that we should just be kind of singularly focused. But I mean, ultimately, you know, when you're a small movement, I was listening to a lecture by Jonathan Bowden where he talked about this recently, and he said that our purpose now is to form a kind of intellectual vanguard. And, you know, critical theory and all this stuff, it is left-wing, but I could conceivably see there being a right-wing critical theory. There's no reason that we couldn't have that. And there are kind of elements of it forming organically now on the dissident right. And, you know, ultimately, the people that kind of attack the intellectualism, they'll be the same people to say that a small group of intellectual elites subverted and destroyed Western civilization in a couple of generations through academia. So, you know, if you really think that there's that much power to be wielded through intellectualism, it's surely a route that as a small dissident group, we should be focused on winning victories. And, you know, we don't have to, of course, we're never going to win victories within the academic establishment or in the mainstream, but I think it is important to offer an alternative paradigm through which societal events can be understood.
And understanding like the true nature of power as well, in a philosophical way, which or our enemies have done all of these things. Distributist made a great tweet. He was arguing against one of these like sort of accelerationist types, the proprietarian types they've got in America. And it's kind of like, we've got the guns, bring on the civil war, we can handle it. And it's trying to explain to them that you actually don't have any power at all. You don't have any cultural power. You don't even have any military power. You don't have any financial power. The idea of going up against the machine with a couple of shotguns and a pickup truck is absolutely insane. But what the distributors tried to outline what power actually was, and he said if you take there was, I think it must have been on Genghis Khan or something, and there was a woman could like walk from Ulaanbaatar to from Afghanistan to Iran or something, holding a nugget of gold, thousands of miles from any kind of local governments or militias or armies or anything. And the power of I think it was Genghis Khan, his power, and people were so fearful of him that they wouldn't actually touch her because that was just that's power, because they knew the retribution. Whereas when you look at and what he went on to say, if you look at the right in America, they can be beaten up on the streets and have milkshakes thrown all over them and have their heads split open, and the police won't do a damn thing about it.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is, a few of these pages have popped up in the last couple of years and have kind of exploded out of nowhere that they're advocating for a civil war and a collapse and all this. And, you know, I will just say outright, I think they're feds. I think one especially, I've seen someone that's shown me like algorithms and some research he's done, because he works with like social media promotion and a lot of this stuff. And he's basically proven that this very channel, prominent channel on YouTube is AstroTurfed. I won't name the channel, but this very prominent channel that popped up out of nowhere was suddenly getting 500,000 views advocating for civil war. I mean, yeah, you have to be very suspicious about these kinds of movements, you know.
It's interesting that, say, Zurius will get deleted. When he never speaks, he just makes music.
Exactly.
But somebody who's sort of saying we can let's bring on the Civil War. I've got a shotgun. He kind of sticks around for a long time, and it's because true power. It's because they're aware of cultural power in a way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like that meme that goes around a lot. You know, Homer Simpson reading the back of his hand, and it's always do the opposite of what the you know who's say. And it's like, that's a good guide. I mean, if the elite wants the dissident right to be out causing trouble and attacking minorities and trying to start a civil war, and if they very clearly don't want ridicule and intelligent critiques of their own narratives, it's very obvious which tactic you should be following.
Yeah.
And they make it very clear what they want and what they don't want.
Yeah, that brings us on to something that we can get into. I'll read out a few more super chats, and it was one of the videos which you made, which I really like. But Nick X, £10, thank you very much, Nick, and everybody else, of course. There's no escape to see racist. Well, there's no escape to see racist race as racist. Not to see it as racist. To avoid speaking to different races is racist. Unsolvable paradox. Confuse and control the fighting population. Yeah, it absolutely is. It absolutely is. Avalok, I think that's Rand. Two Rand. Hundreds of militias trained by Stalin, South America. I'm willing to concede ground there. I don't know enough. Fair enough. That could be the case. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I mean, I'll look into that.
Etienne Vac, £5. Thank you very much. Remote working. I'm having a hard time reading because my eyes falling down my face. Remote working in contract IT programming roles contra 9-to-5 wage slavery seems most conducive to achieving localized self-sufficient communities. Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of the sort of traditionalist types will sort of sniff at the idea of sitting in a cubicle behind a computer or if you can work from home, I don't know. And then Etan Vak again, £2. Thoughts on the racially conscious left? Well, I think we got into that before a bit. They're most certainly racially conscious, but in a negative way, and purely a negative way towards Europeans. I'm not aware of, or to themselves, more likely to themselves, I think. Keith?
Yeah, do you think that question's maybe directed at like the old school left that were more nationalistic, maybe?
All right. Well, I mean, they've been completely purged.
Yeah,
that's what's went on. The sort of the last gasp of that in Britain was probably the BNP, and now they'll settle for whatever populist movements around. But a lot of them are just kind of ignorant. I mean, one would say racially conscious. Racial consciousness is like the default position. And so because a lot of working class whites, the kind of people who I work with, my family and so on, they are mainly racially conscious by default, but just because they haven't been through higher education.
Yeah, I mean, it's like no trade union ever voted for open borders. This was completely a revolution from above. And I really think it's important to try and forge some kind of third position, because you are right. I mean, the working class, on the whole, are racist. That's a fact. They're ethnically aware. They're very nationalistic. But then what happens is, they vote in the party that makes promises about immigration and they get stabbed in the back. And then they vote for a party that look out for their economic interests or claim to, which is, you know, one of these left-wing parties, and they have to sacrifice this nationalist element. And in somewhere like Ireland, there is no party you can vote for if you're opposed to open borders. For the last century, we've been swapping between two centrist, centre-right political parties. Occasionally, the Labour Party, like the Trade Union Party, would be in as a coalition member. But we haven't had a big leftist party. But all that happened was, once these parties embraced this model of economic development based on foreign direct investment in the 1970s, we had this massive cultural shift, especially in the 90s, within a few years, where we went from this kind of, in some people's minds, a backward Catholic country off the coast of Europe, underdeveloped, and along came the economic development, and with it came the social revolution. And there was never a radical leftist party involved.
Yeah. I remember working with a couple of Irish lads in the early 2000s, and they like to take the piss out of me for the state of England. and I warned them because we were in Europe, and I said, look around, it's everywhere. There's no way Ireland's going to escape this. And their point was that it couldn't happen in Ireland because there wasn't enough people in Ireland. And, well, here we are. But it's interesting that, yeah, the money and the rest of it all comes together. The progress. It's all progress, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, these things always go hand in hand, you know. When you get multinational corporations like Google coming in, and then you get suddenly you go from one of the most religious countries in Europe to overwhelmingly passing abortion and gay marriage referendums. When you get organizations like the IMF coming in and part of their program for providing debt relief to your country is that you have to, you know, liberalize your economy. You know, these things all go hand in hand, and the social revolution is often brought about by an economic liberalism that comes before it.
It's just like a vast machine, isn't it? I liked one of your videos when you were talking about irony and how in sort of post-modernity, irony is the default position of everything. Nothing can be taken very seriously at all.
Yeah, I mean, I said this to my friend the other day. I was like, you know, when you go through, you look at girls on Tinder and they all have this ironic bio, like, here's what my whatever says about me, or, you know, they all have this ironic shit. When you look at the TV and the banks are marketing you mortgages with these self-aware advertisements, that's like, you know, this is the part of the advertisement where I tell you we're a bank. This is the part of the advertisement where I tell you that we have the best rates on mortgages. And it's all this layers and layers of a self-aware, cynical irony. And when this is so pervasive that it's coming from these corporations that are meant to be representative of, like, the man, there's nothing transgressive about irony anymore. You know, when the low IQ thoughts are communicating in this stuff, you know, it's run its course.
Yeah, and they what's funny is that they can't stand a sort of sarcasm and irony being directed back at the cathedral, as the new reactionaries say. If you look at the alt right, it was sort of a kind of double irony directed back at the system, and all of a sudden this sort of like the fellow was saying in the chat before, sort of deconstructing the deconstructors, when that's returned fire, and when it's in the form of a meme which sort of pokes fun at them and you know has a laugh at them and stuff, they really can't stand it, and it's just shut it down straight away. And it's funny because you think you could just how excited could they get about it all?
Yeah, that's why I think it's interesting that the alt-right came alongside this meme culture, because what I see happened was, you know, much like Jackson Pollock's paintings are like the end point of the trend of modernism and art, where you're left to question what art is, and you're left without a reference point. What happened in the last few years is irony was taken to such an extent that memes turned into this concoction of reference points on top of reference points, irony on top of irony, all these layers of irony, to the point where trending meme was a deep fried picture of Lord Farquaad from Shrek with the letter E on it. And it's like a deconstruction of irony itself, where you take it to such an absurd level and deconstruct it that it ceases to lose its transgressive nature. And I think that's actually, that creates an environment that's conducive to a dialectic that's a counter to postmodernism. And Trump's election campaign was an example of that, because the trend of postmodernism is this ironic cynicism to everything. You know, it's exemplified by something like The Simpsons, and it reached its peak in the 90s. And you'll find some interesting stuff from the writer David Foster Wallace from the 90s, where he predicted that this would come to an end, that people now, when he was speaking, were being raised on The Simpsons, and they were being raised on this constant diet of irony and cynicism. And, you know, as you get older, you tend to rebel against what you grew up with and question established norms. And one time the outlet for that was irony and was this pervasive cynicism and nihilism. But when you grow up in the generation after Gen X, and the establishment has been forever pushing this cynical worldview, then the transgressive thing is actually to be sincere. Now, they can deconstruct the sincerity of someone like a Christian conservative in the United States, because this is kind of a pre-ironic sincerity. On some level, they just don't get it. But Trump had this post-ironic sincerity, where he did believe the things he was saying, and he really did want to build a wall and kick out illegals, or at least we thought at the time. But he also had the necessary cover of irony that makes this kind of speech acceptable, and gives it this feel of being even more transgressive than the very postmodern bent of irony.
Yeah, that's well said. Yeah, it's fascinating. It's well said that. And you think, it's as if irony, there was an old pop band called Pop Will Eat Itself, which it did. But I think it's safe to say that irony will eat itself as well. Especially like you were saying with The Simpsons. And in a way, The Simpsons, I remember there were some great articles up at Countercurrents on South Park after the Trump election. And they were like exactly what you were saying just there, actually, where South Park has always been subversive against the mainstream narrative. But the problem that they had was that how do they tackle somebody like Trump and the Trump alt-right kind of thing that was going on a couple of years ago, when that is itself subversive? It would have to be where South Park would have to actually get on board with that. And what they tried to do was to use that same kind of 90s Gen X irony against Trump, and it killed the ratings of South Park because, well, they end up just being boring, because they're not as they're like a layer of irony behind, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and this actually makes me think of something we were saying earlier, which is that you know, we were talking about this kind of false opposition, and how the people criticizing this are operating under this kind of unquestioned relativism that doesn't actually make any sense, because they can't defend any of their positions. And it's like, in postmodernism, you know, the postmodernism is it's like centrally defined as like, it was this rejection of the meta narrative. You know, there's nothing greater than the individual. And so it brings in this trend of cynicism against any kind of meta-narrative, any kind of collectivism, things like religion, nationalism. And when this is pervasive so long, really, if you deconstruct this further through the use of irony, you come to the realization that, well, in this nihilistic, relativistic worldview, I can just as easily build a wall and kick out illegals, and we can all LARP as national socialists, as I can LARP as an anarchist that wants all this bullshit. It's just as arbitrary. So, you know, let's have a bit of fun and go with the fun one.
Yeah, yeah. And there was that, I think she's called, is it Alicia or Cortez or something that they've
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, yeah.
Yeah, and she had some pictures of herself like sort of alongside a chicken wire fence last week.
Oh yeah, I remember this.
And you can see that. So in this case, that is like them, the sort of global homo machine, trying to be earnest and trying to be heartfelt, and then it just gets turned into this ridiculous meme. And it's like, well, you can't be serious, even if the other side of that fence was full of dead people. People would still find it funny to take the piss out of it. And you see, like, the sort of the chickens coming home to roost.
Yeah, it is. It's like Frankenstein's monster, you know. When they were out of power, they thought they could create this and unleash it on the stuffy conservatives. But now they're the establishment, and it's coming back to bite them. And they have no idea how to deal with this, which is makes for some really entertaining viewing now, watching them trying to contain it.
I mean, I even had a crack at doing a meme myself, and my because everybody was doing their own takes on it, and mine was that I posted the pictures of her next to the fence, and then the one where she's kind of buckled over and crying, and then I posted a picture of a burst football, and that's nothing worse when your football goes into a grumpy old man cracked its garden. And with pictures of her crying next to the fence. And it's just you've got to take a punt on it and have a laugh at it. But and it's just, yeah, everything's ironic. You can't take anything seriously. So they don't take it seriously when a man is gutted because he doesn't have control over his girlfriend having an abortion, for example. A man just has to deal with the fact that his child can be aborted. And if he kicks up a stink or anything like that, he is met with kind of irony from the left and irony from the machine. And we don't take it too seriously. We'll laugh at him. And then when they're going to stand next to a chicken wire fence crying about whatever, you know, the migrants on the other side or whatever it was, they then expect in return that we are like shamed or embarrassed, or oh yeah, I see the point now. Of course not. Everybody's like you are saying. It's just we're all drowning in postmodern irony. Nothing can be taken seriously anymore, and they brought it about.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, when you're in power, this is what you fear, because for these people, they really have no counter against this, so they have to do this like a pathetic shred of trying to pretend that they're actually not the establishment, and the establishment is actually Christian white males, and that's who you should be directing your cynicism at. But the problem for them now is absolutely no one buys it, and people go to websites like the Daily Stormer and find them very entertaining. And you know, once people it's not even about argument, but once people just start laughing at your entire worldview and your entire message, and when no one takes what you say seriously anymore, there's no coming back from that. And the only way you can maintain power then is through force and coercion. And that's more and more what the system is moving towards, with censorship and everything else. I mean, you know all about that living in the UK.
Oh, yeah, I know all about that. I'm going to go for a few super chats and then we'll get back on track. Right, so we've got Itan Vak, £2. Thank you very much. Keith, what country are you from? I would have thought that was an easy one.
Guess. Ireland, the west of Ireland.
The west of Ireland.
Yeah. I grew up pretty rural.
Captain F, €20. Great discussion. As a fellow Irishman, it's heartening to know that I'm not alone. We need to offer something fresh and idealistic to our young lads that will act as a real alternative to the pause. Keep up the great work, Morgoth. I will do. Thank you very much. Nick X, £10. Size will not save you. Recently leaked documents from the US Embassy in Estonia came to light, which showed the US promoting the benefits of diversity in a tiny Baltic state. Size, right. So, yeah, it's where was that? US Embassy in Estonia is promoting multiculturalism in Estonia. I mean, you'd think that would cost a, like, that would be a diplomatic incident, you know, and it won't be, because how do you argue against it? I mean, in their country. It's interesting because you could say that are countries which haven't been sort of somewhere like Hungary, that we've developed, like we've been talking about irony and sort of under subversion and counter subversion using humor and irony. And it does make you wonder that a country like Estonia might be particularly vulnerable, the country who hasn't developed these sort of antibodies, even basic ones like, you know, oh, diversity is our strength, is like being completely subverted and thrown back at the system. And these some of these smaller Eastern European countries, I hope their traditionalism saves them, but or at least I hope that they're starting to pick up some of the sort of things that happen on the dissident right in the West.
Yeah, I've often thought that as well. I mean, Ken Wilber is a philosopher that writes about the pre-trans fallacy, where people think that if they can go back to a certain period of time, that they can reverse the negative effects of the interim period. But really, by going back, you're going back to a time where you haven't had the experience of dealing with that fall in the first place. And so he calls the when someone mistakes, you know, being trans-rational for pre-rational. So there are pre-rational worldviews, you know, Aborigines in Australia, and yeah, these kind of pagan worldviews, but there are also trans-rational worldviews. It's possible to operate outside the episteme of this materialist scientific worldview without going back to some kind of magic or shamanism. And it's like that for irony as well. There are nationalists that are like, they're like trans postmodernism. They're like, they've got this meta-modern attitude to society and to culture, and you shouldn't mistake that for the kind of the pre-ironic pre-postmodern worldview. And I think that that is very open to subversion, and I think people like Putin are very aware of this when they see what's going on in the West.
Yeah, and then it relies on them enforcing censorship to keep all of that at bay. So somebody like Putin and definitely Viktor Orban will be aware of these subversive elements, let's say, operating within Hungary, and he seems to be quite censorious about it, because in that way they are fragile. They would be fragile to a sort what we would regard as a bit of a cringe 2002 tier leftism. I mean, yeah, I mean, they haven't actually managed to develop, even in the West, they haven't actually made their messaging that much more sophisticated. There's just more of it. But I suppose I can see like a young girl in Hungary getting tempted by some like sort of propaganda in a way that people in the West have become kind of numb to it.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting you say that, because now I think about it, there's a lot of Poles in Ireland, and obviously Poland is kind of held up by the right as this like traditional nationalist place. But like when I think of the stuff I see them sharing and discussing, it's very, you know, it's like anonymous, you know, they're still doing the anonymous thing. And it's like, you know, Trump is trying to start World War III, and it's all this like weird kind of like vaguely leftist, anarchist, conspiratorial thinking that, you know, the establishment is the rich white men. And it's, yeah, they seem to be much more open to that in a way that maybe people in the West have become kind of immune to it.
I mean, there's a statistic which gets thrown around in Britain, which is that this gets thrown around a lot. It's a kind of a trope, and I wouldn't want to hitch me bandwagon to it. Like, but it is said that Polish girls have the highest rate of sort of mixed race births in of all groups in Britain. So there's the sort of Polish diaspora which came over here are like, apparently that there's a lot of the girls being drawn to non-white men. That triggers a lot of people, but I see that going around quite a lot. But I can kind of understand it with what you were saying before, where you've got a sort of culture which isn't used to subversion And then all you've got is the traditionalism to hold it in line. And then you've got that mid sort of period, which is probably the most destructive. And then you've got another one where you begin to sort of develop some antibodies against it, which might be the case in the West now. People would may well disagree with that, but I think there's something to it.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting you said about that statistic. That sounds kind of right to me, just based on my observations even here. And I think that probably applied to Irish women a lot that used to migrate to Britain in the 70s and 80s. You know, you think there's a lot of prominent cultural figures in Ireland, like, you know, Paul McGrath, the ex-football player, who's one of our great soccer players for the American fans. And he was an Irish mother and a black father that she met in England. She was a single mother, surprisingly enough. And then, what's your man's name? The musician, his name has completely gone out of my head. Sorry?
From Thin Lizzy.
Yeah.
Phil Lynott?
Yeah, Phil Lynott. So his mother as well is she was an Irish woman that went over to Britain for work or whatever and had a kid with a black English guy, you know, well, English in quotation marks, and her family kind of deserted her. So there did seem to be a trend of that as well, English Irish women getting the boat over to England, and, you know, they're kind of free to transgress the social and cultural norms that they couldn't back home.
I mean, it'll also explain why the system just keeps sort of piling on the race mixing adverts that everybody notices. I mean, that's the quickest way to get to sort of pour sand in the gears of the system. If you're talking to somebody at work or down the pub, you can bring that up and everybody has noticed it. And you don't have to own it either. You can just say, if they can say, oh, are you a racist? You can always just wash your hands of it and say, it's just something that I thought was weird, just something that I noticed. And it does click straight away. They do get it.
Yeah, that was kind of a freeing thing as well. You know, for a long time, I used to beat around the bush and try this kind of, this normicon stuff that you can maybe, you know, slip a red pill into their drink. But really, I mean, the best approach is to just not even just come out and say it, but actually amplify it. And, you know, go the Daily Stormer route and just shock them and make them think you're a monster. And then they'll actually be more willing to listen to you if you go in with that approach, because at least you're being honest. And it's somewhat entertaining for them as well to see someone that is transgressing these social norms that they never see transgressed.
Yeah, I did that at work as well. Basically, just went full, you know, the full load, because I was sort of always I had to listen to Radio 1 all of the time, and I kind of just pulled it all to bits, and because they would come up with counter arguments, and then obviously, you know, it was easy to knock it all down, eventually pointing out to like who was behind all of this and stuff. What one thing that was interesting as well, I'm just on this subject, was that as a sort of conscious experiment, now this is like a video which I was going to make one day, but I'll just kind of do it on now another stream. And it was to do with the radio. This is sort of a critical theory thing. And we would always have Crapital FM on or Radio 1. And what I did was just constant, especially Stormzy as well. Somebody's asking about the Morrissey situation. I think we'll round up on that. But just in terms of, so everybody was happy to listen to Crapital FM and Radio 1, and it is just rap music and just sort of plastic, horrible pop. It's just fucking awful. And what I started to do was just constantly take the piss out of it in a sort of racist and subversive way, all of the time. And I would be asking people, like, why are you listening? And they're explaining the lyrics and what he was actually listening to, as they were all white men. And I just didn't stop. I was just like taking the piss out of it day in, day in, day in, day out. And then eventually it's kind of nobody wanted to defend what was on the radio anymore. It was just sort of there. And then one day I just went over and switched it on to Absolute 90, which was a bit more, you know, a bit more Gen X, and I could listen to like Radiohead and Oasis, which was a lot more of an improvement. And then after that, I kept going, and then eventually I ended up on like Planet Rock or something, and listening to like 70s prog rock. And the point of it is, you can kind of push the discourse. Like critical theory does actually work. So if you think we're in say British culture, if you're constantly being called a racist, then your history is just blood spatters, and you're evil. All white people are evil. All you've ever done is rape the world, and everything about white people is negative, and blah blah blah. If that's the way critical theory kind of grinds down Europeans. And so then what happens is the people just decide to change the station and change the population in this case. And you find that, well, you haven't really got a leg to stand on because you've already conceded so much ground. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, you will be surprised how open people are to a radical message. You know, you see a certain kind of person that's pushed out in the media, but it really isn't what people believe. And I mean, the people that actually believe all this stuff, you know, critical race theory and all this stuff, I mean, I don't want to like just do a genetic argument against them and not engage them. But I mean, you will find that these people generally, they tend to be deficient in some way mentally or sexually. Or, you know, there is some, they're not normal people. And maybe their constant deconstruction of normalcy and normal society is a rejection or a reaction against that. But you know, these people, sometimes ordinary people that you talk to, you have to remember that they've gone through years and years of brainwashing where they've been taught that this is the only acceptable cultural message. And even if they have an intuition that it's wrong, they've never seen anyone to articulate that. So you have to consider that while they may be reluctant at first, you're probably the first person to articulate these views to them. And so they may actually be a lot more responsive than you think, because you may actually be articulating things that they deeply feel themselves, but they don't see any expression of it.
Yeah. I mean, a gentle way to do it, to, as you put it, slyly slip a red pill into their drink, is to just say kind of offhandedly, have you ever noticed what goes on in the adverts? And then, of course, you can just say the adverts are promoting white genocide. Just go boom, straight in there. And then kind of after the shock waves die down, just kind of dig in a little bit and explain it all. It is funny. I mean, actually talking about red people in real life, is that could be a whole other stream. I've got a lot of stories about that. Okay, I'll read out a few super chats. We've got Krillin876, $2 US. Have you guys discussed the situation with Morrissey? I think we'll get onto that right now. First Soy Battalion, 75th Bugman Regiment, $14.99. Thank you very much, lad. The current order is unsustainable, but we will have to have patience. We must exist as the apparatus that shields people as they see their living standards tumble. Great guest and love from Kentucky. Thank you very much, friend. By the way, that wasn't his writing. That's because I cannot see properly because of my bloody eye. Barry Bones, £110. Thank you very much, Barry. Stop watching the news. The news contrives to frighten you. I think the news does a lot. I think it presents a completely false picture from the very moment that you switch it on. I think the news does makes you frightened of what the system wants you to be frightened of. But in other areas, the way it's presented and it's so slick, it is as if to sort of say, like at a macro level, it also says we've got this under control. But, you know, like say Tommy Robinson, far-right extremist, will be on there the night, and you've got to be scared of him. It'll direct the NPCs in that direction. But if there's been some sort of major terrorist attack and 20 people are dead, it's calming what they do. Then it's like, don't worry, we've got this. It's a bad incident. Don't panic too much.
Yeah, I mean, it's that thing. It scares you in a certain way where it'll just leave you in a kind of state of perpetual confusion about what's going on and about who exactly the enemy is or why any of this is happening. And then it'll give you their medicine, which is, you know, just trust the experts, trust the technocrats. You know, we'll keep this under control.
Yeah, trust the experts. I mean, yeah, there's so much we could talk about. That's a whole other thing where it's an appeal to authority. The system loves an appeal to authority, doesn't it? There was a thing came out this week about English, and apparently only like 10% of people surveyed by this think tank, which has got, and you know, when you look at who funds them, it's just like a massive list of globalists, core, like global core. Even George Soros was there, and they had this thing, and it was like only 10% of the people in England who they surveyed said that English, like to be English, you've got to be like, it's an ethnicity, you've got to be white. But they didn't actually release how the questions were worded. And they didn't sort of go into detail of the context, or they didn't tell you who was surveyed. So we don't know if it was in central London or in rural Cumbria, or if it was just all over the country. And then they don't tell you anything like that. They just release the statistics as fact without any context. But they're experts, so we'll just have to believe that as an objective fact now.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing too how much you can control people by manipulating language. And that's really what the whole political correctness thing is built on. And it's easy to control the opposition through getting a handle on the linguistic paradigms that these things operate on, because while you'll always get people to oppose certain groups or certain people, you know, you'll see the an example would be the so-called Marxist professors or leftist professors in the UK who supported staying in the EU, and it's because they're wedded to this this social program that's an effect of neoliberalism, and they see the EU as the means to progress that, and so they abandon the economic issue. And so, you know, with control of the linguistic paradigm, it's easy to take an abstract value like, you know, freedom or anti-racism, and not just to put it in the words of your own people promoting your own agenda, but then to frame it so that anyone opposed to them has to borrow this linguistic paradigm. I guess a good example is this cringeworthy stuff of conservatives calling Antifa a white identitarian group. Like, the only way you can criticize a militant, violent group is if you can get the normies to think that they're more like the Nazis than the other people are.
Yeah, yeah. And it's what... I mean, I know Mike Enoch and some of the lads in America have been doing their ends about this, and I can really see why. And my particular take on it, because it was people like Tim Pool who kicked this off, and what drives me nuts about it is that you see how facile the free-thinking individualists of the centre are, the centrists are, because what they're trying to do there, and it's like Antifa, the real fascists, and it's because the consensus after World War II, which was purely synthetic and, you know, driven out of the media by the you-know-whos, the idea was that there would be a new morality, and sort of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis would be like the ultimate incarnation of evil. And then, so in order to get away from that, you've got to be, into the path of light and goodness. You then have to become anti-racist and anti-everything they were. Now, the people who, I said this on the Iconoclast thing, and I'm going to say it again, and I'll probably say it again in the future. The people who sort of think of themselves as being big brain centrists, they have adopted that narrative like all the way. And yet they're then going to try and figure it out in their minds, and they're going to say, well, Antifa are evil, so therefore Antifa are also fascists, because they're stuck in this dialectic. And these are the people who fucking run around on the internet thinking of themselves as being these sort of, you know, the independent minds, these individuals, nobody's spoon feeding them narratives. They can feel they know about Descartes. They you know what I mean? It's the same thing again. They've been fed this narrative all their lives, and they're going to try and sort of peddle it as if they've came to this conclusion themselves. It's complete rubbish. And the people who they say are like brainwashed collectivists are the people who are actually thinking freely on the matter and can see that they're falling into this dialectical trap.
Yeah, I mean, I almost have more respect for these insane critical theorists, postmodernists, post-postmodernists, leftists, than I do for these so-called free thinkers. You know, I mean, fundamentally, people like Dave Rubin and all these big brain centrists, fundamentally, they're just not very bright, because they'll constantly pay lip service to free thinking and ideas, but they literally can't conceive of having a worldview outside of a very narrow 18th century liberalism that was created at a particular time and place based on particular historical, economic, social conditions. And to them, everything that's a rejection of that, that's automatically, that's that belief refuted, because you know, you're not matching up to classical liberalism's view of the state. You know, the Sergan thing, have you even read Locke? And it's like, you can be intelligent. There's a certain level of intelligence where you can offer good critiques of people within a paradigm, but it takes another level of just, I would say, critical thinking to look at things in a more meta way and to see the contingencies that are underlying your belief system. And what is a characteristic of centrists and of these classical liberals is that they're totally incapable of this meta-analysis. And that's why they get left behind in these discussions. And that's why the left just sees them as a joke. And I really don't think we should take them seriously on very much anything.
No, I don't. I mean, they seem to be... they don't seem to be the sort of force they were a few years ago. They really seem to be sort of dwindling away. I don't know. You know, I don't really... I think they're kind of boring. I don't know what they're up to. I don't watch their takes on anything anymore either. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think what happens is people get interested in politics, and maybe that's an avenue in there. Maybe they're the first people you encounter. You know, you hear about Jordan Peterson or whatever. But if you have the kind of mind that you're interested in political issues, sociological, philosophical issues in the first place, you're probably looking at the world in a more meta-political, more philosophical way. And so you're not going to be satisfied with going this one layer down, you know, one layer deeper, where just go back to the Enlightenment and just accept this other arbitrary category of beliefs without the changes that have been made to it in the interim 200 years. If you have that mindset, you're going to look for a more coherent vision of the world and of society. And so I don't think anyone can really last that long in the classical liberal camp unless you just lack that kind of that insight into the more as I say, metapolitical assumptions that's underlying these discussions.
Yeah And it reminds me of the sort of Flatland. Was this thing, I think it was Carl Sagan, and these sort of pop physicists came up with this concept of what would it be like if you were in an alternate universe and there was only two dimensions. And so you see these kind of sticks, kind of, and then somebody places a football in between them, and they're trying to figure out, because they've only got two dimensions, but there's a three-dimensional thing in the middle of them, and they're trying to figure it out what it is, and they just see it as being like a flat circle on the floor. And that's kind of what the classic liberals have been reduced to in the current year. I'll do some super chats, and I think we'll round up with the Morrissey thing, as everybody was. Alt Media, US $10. Thank you very much. Greetings from America. This is one of the few times I get to catch live streams as they happen due to time zone differences. That's nice. And Fiac. Oh, I think I got that one right. US dollars, $25. Irish nationalist here a few years back. I never thought I'd be supporting English-British nationalism, but yet here I am. Thanks for everything you're doing, Morgoth. No problem. Thank you very much for the super chat. I mean, I've always been partial to sort of just nattering on with the lads, and I think Keith is a good lad. Don't forget, check out his channel. I think we need to be. Why people are like me, because I do have a sort of heavy accent and I am a bit rough around the edges, but I'm kind of authentic. I don't pretend to be anything I'm not. I think it's probably going to be the same for you as well, Keith.
Just speaking to that person that said they never thought they'd be supporting English nationalism, I definitely felt the same way, because Irish nationalism is so... It really forms its identity, of course, based on the history of oppression by the English. And it'd take a lot of time to cover it. But that's an interesting topic, is the fact that we have this perfect foundation for nationalism. You know, the founders of the 1916 rebellion, people like Pádraig Piers, he was basically a fascist. And you have this great potential for a nationalist movement. You know, the mythos is there. The language, the history of struggle, of nationalism, racialism. But what basically is happening is, instead, they're saying that it wasn't a nationalist struggle. It was basically an anti-colonial struggle. And basically, the enemy was imperialism, and the comrades of Irish people are other countries that were colonized. People like, you know, the Nigerians that are driving the taxis, and the Indians that will work on the computers or become the prime minister, as there is one here now, and that's who you should form your comradeship with, is the other victims of colonialism, because it does fit into their leftist narrative. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, you have to realize that these squabbles between Europeans, you know, it's like bickering with your brother over whose turn it is on the PlayStation while your house has been invaded. You know, yeah. We have to put these aside and just focus on what's going on, or there'll be no future for any of us.
And especially because war isn't actually, war and colonialism and things like that aren't actually the preoccupations of the common man. That it's always the business of the elites and the banks. And I think we've all had quite enough of that. And that is actually where we are now. Because they've just gone completely berserk in more recent years. And so you find that the common man in Kentucky, as that fella before, or an Irishman and an Englishman, the common man in Sweden, we all have common cause against this behemoth, this satanic beast, which has got us got all our cards marked. And the new paradigm will be something completely different, but I don't know what it'll be just yet. So I've got Serena JB for £5. Hello, Serena. I know Serena. Thanks for the big brain takes. Would you consider using entropy as a way of taking super chats, GF and P? That's Mark Collett's show, I think. Patriotic Weekly Report are using it with success. I'll have a look at it. I'm a complete moron with technology. I'll have to get me team to tell us what that is and what I have to do. Steve, thanks a lot, Serena. Steve and Bob, another £2. Really enjoyed this. Two great minds. Thank you very much. I think we could go on and on, actually, but Chuck Ford, US dollars, $5. Greetings from the USA. Thanks a lot, Chuck. All the best. So we've been going for an hour and a half. I thought we'll wrap up with the Morrissey situation, because I'm on my own channel and I haven't actually done a take on it since. There's like a big article about Countercurrents on it. We got into it on the Iconoclast. There's been a lot of stuff. I don't really know what to say about it. How did Morrissey come across my video, or was it even him that put it on his website? There seems to be some discussion about that. I don't know. But as far as what Morrissey's sort of involved with For Britain, and the way the YouTube algorithm seems to work is that they'll suggest things for you sort of loosely based on what you've already watched. And I actually did a video called Thoughts on Fort Britain. And so if somebody's watching a video like Morrissey Michaels, he supports Fort Britain, if he's watching their content or that kind of thing, it's very possible that at somewhere one of my videos popped up, or it's just that it was his nephew or whatever it was. It could well be that Morrissey never watched the video and it was his nephew. So I just don't know. But the general gist really resonated with people. And by the way, that video was a really quick one. It's like videos where I just put the mic on and just ran for like 10 minutes. Always take off, but something like me video on Sam Peckinpah's Pat Garrett and Billy Kid just sinks without a trace, and it'll be like it was so much work. But all right, whatever. I can't complain. My channel's doing very well. I think people like to see the. I mean, we've talked about it a lot tonight. Well, people like to see the left being or and their sort of pets and the system being exposed as a bunch of shills. And people aren't used to seeing that. People have to get out of this mindset that Antifa and the left and the social justice warriors and all of the things which go with that, all of different agendas that they're pushing. Get it out of your minds that is in any way anti-establishment. It isn't, and attack it from a dissident point of view. And they hate that. And people like Billy Bragg and the rest of them, they didn't criticize my video on that. They just called me a white supremacist and a racist. They can't actually meet us on that terrain. There was a valid social critique in my video, even if, you know, maybe I was a bit over the top on the language and stuff, but there was a valid social critique, and Billy Bragg and the rest of them never went anywhere near it because they know it's true. Any thoughts there, Keith?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed that video, and it just gets at this thing again, you know, when you live in clown world, the greatest act of rebellion is laughter and just ridiculing and poking fun at this. And if you want evidence, you just look at how the establishment reacts to this kind of stuff. And if there's one thing that they hate, it's ordinary people pointing and laughing at them and seeing through the years of brainwashing.
Yeah. All right. I've really enjoyed it. I've got my eyes streaming down my face. Oh, thanks to Lady Rothgar, I'll get me sell some eye drops. Any parting shots? Everybody, check out Keith's channel because it's great. A lot of good takes. I mean, this is really one thing I do. I want to have a bit of a moan before we wrap up, and it's that too many people are doing live streams like this. But what we need is more thoughtful videos, 10 minutes long, getting thoughts and ideas out there. Something's in the news. Have a nationalist reactionary take on it. That's what I like to see. I find myself like with nothing much to watch on YouTube these days, but there's like hours and hours and hours of people live streaming all the time. And I know I'm saying that on a live stream, I know. But all right, it's been great having you, Keith. Are you going to come back on again?
Yeah, I'd be happy to be here again. I think there's a lot we could discuss.
Yeah, I think there is. I think we'll definitely have another chat. It'll be fun. Right. Any parting shots?
I mean, not really. I guess just tell people, you know, keep trying to red pill within your own community. And I think, you know, you're talking about the short 10-minute videos. I think there is a space now that we've seen. You know, the right in many ways has kind of, it's lost a lot of battles the last few years, and things haven't looked very hopeful. But ultimately, you know, no one saw the 2016 election of Trump coming. And ultimately, there is going to be a cataclysmic event of some kind down the road. I'm not necessarily saying it'll be disastrous, but there will be some paradigm shifting event, and there will be a vacuum of ideology to be filled. And we know that what people want is this third position of national populism, you know, social conservatism and economic populism. We know that there's a hunger there for that. We know that there's many layers of brainwashing, but that it's very open to being torn down by the kind of irony and ridicule that we've talked about. And so we know that there's space for this intellectual vanguard of the right now to form. And it is doing so organically. There has been this organic formation of this dissident right with its own hierarchy based on merit, which is quite interesting to see. And there has been development of intellectual ideas within that. And there has been this dialectic where, you know, ideas like libertarianism and some other ideas were rejected and better ideas were brought in. And so I think there is progress being made. And I think that's the potential for us going forward to craft this third position. There are people doing it in the United States. And I think now we need more people doing it in Europe and not just playing up to the same old tired pro-Israel, kind of vaguely Thatcherite establishment politics with more restrictions on immigration. We need to be radical in our rejection of the kosher sandwich politics, and we need to be radical of our rejection in cultural liberalism and this postmodern quagmire that we've been living under. And that's how the revolution will come. It'll start with this social revolution, winning the hearts and minds, and crafting this genuine alternative for when a real opportunity does arise.
Absolutely. Well said. Well, the way I've all thought about it for a long time is that there's a thing which happens with icebergs, which is called a moulon. And it's where the iceberg, from outside, the iceberg looks really powerful, really solid. But then one day, like half of like 10,000 tons of ice will just drop straight off the front of the iceberg. And what's been happening is that water has been trickling around inside of the iceberg and just slowly weakening the superstructure of it all. And then when it takes a little bump, like half of the whole thing falls off, and people think, how the hell could that happen? And that's actually what happened to Western civilization in the first place. And with sort of layers and layers, three or four layers of irony later, we're kind of doing it in the other direction. So it'll be great to speak again. Thanks for listening, everybody, and thanks to Super Chats, and I'll catch you later.